Blackface. It's hardly a word one would have thought to be heard in the 21st century. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The term has been thrust into the headlines with a political storm that has washed over top politicians in the state of Virginia. Governor Ralph Northam's medical school yearbook shows someone in blackface standing next to someone in robes of the Ku Klux Klan. At the top of the page is the governor's name. First, he apologized, then denied he was in the picture, but did say that he appeared in blackface to imitate Michael Jackson. As denunciations and calls for his resignation gushed forth, the state attorney general, Mark Herron, admitted that he, too, had appeared in blackface as a rapper. White's appearing in blackface reaches back to the 19th century in America, but has also reappeared in recent comedy sketches on such programs as Saturday Night Live. To say the least, there has been a backlash against these kinds of images in the wake of the Virginia scandals. We take a look at the history and significance of the current national attention to this issue. We have in our studio this morning Dr. Joshua Wright, associate professor at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He is an author and historian and has followed the image of African Americans in the United States. And welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, just sort of on a personal level, what was your reaction as this scandal unfolded first with Governor Northam, and then we had Mark Herring as well?
Honestly, I wasn't surprised. This type of thing's been happening quite a bit. And if you follow social media, you see so many blackface parties happening on college campuses, fraternities, sororities, Halloween parties. So seeing the governor do it, I mean, really didn't shock me at all. And then also given Virginia's history, you know, going back to the Civil War and earlier. And then you had Charlottesville, was just in Virginia about a year or two ago. So it really didn't shock me at all.
So let's go back to a little history here, because blackface really emerges with minstrel shows. I understand actually somebody was an actor in New York, actually, who created some of these. Tell us a little bit about the what seems now ancient history.
Right. So the term minstrel actually comes from an art form that was popularized in medieval Europe. All right. And then when you talk about blackface and the minstrel shows here in the United States, that really comes into play around the 1820s. You have Thomas D. Rice and then George Washington Dixon were two of the earliest known blackface performers. And it should be known in the very beginning when they started doing the blackface, we think of it now as men imitating the southern voice of the blacks or the Negroes, as they called them back then, on the southern plantations. But initially, they were imitating black people, but the routines, they sounded more like English white men when they did it in the very beginning. Now, Dixon, the story is that Thomas Rice, he traveled through the South and he saw this black man who had physical issues from arthritis and different things. And I don't know if the gentleman was dancing, but he saw this and then he imitated that on stage. So the song Jump Jim Crow, that's where this originates. And if you've seen pictures of the Jim Crow character, you know, that's where he's taken this from. So then you have these guys, and as I say, this is in the 1820s, in the 1830s and the 1840s, blackface minstrelsy really starts to take off, particularly in the North. People think of it as a Southern art form, but it really rose in the North in places such as New York City and Boston and Philadelphia. And you know, it would eventually become the most popular form of entertainment and pop culture within America. And it's also important when you think about the fact that, you know, while this is something that's Southern, that is happening in the North. And you have to ask yourself, well, why the North and why the Northeast in particular, and why these particular places and this time frame? So if we look at history, you know, during this time, you have immigration. You have Irish coming over and other immigrants coming, and they're experiencing racism. So in the North, you have this upheaval of these new immigrants coming. You have the nativist party forming. You have people who are afraid that these immigrants are going to take away their jobs, that they're going to lead to crime, lead to all sorts of different problems. At the same time, you also have abolition taking place, and Northerners calling for the abolition and the ending of slavery in the South. So it's a very uneasy time, not just for Southerners, but for Northerners as well. So the minstrelsy kind of comes about, I don't want to say in response to that, but as part of that. And then also some have said that the minstrels was a way for these immigrants to actually, almost assimilate into mainstream white culture. Because one of the earliest minstrel performers who gained great success and notoriety was this gentleman named Dan Emmett, who was of Irish descent. And he had the first known minstrel troupe called the Virginia Minstrels. All right. So I think that's really important that you frame it within that history.
And it seems as if in terms of performers that you not only have the Irish, but then other immigrants as well take on that, those roles.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And again, like I say, it's all about allowing them a access almost into the mainstream society and into the culture by adopting these racist stereotypes. Now, the thing about the minstrelsy, and here's a really great quote, and I wrote it down, so I don't want to misquote him, but the author is Eric Lott, and he had this great quote where he refers to blackface as a strange mix of envy, fascination, desire, and fear. And I think that's so powerful because you look at it, it's like, okay, so number one, these people are fascinated by these African Americans, you know, these Southerners that they don't know very much about and they haven't had a lot of contact with. Maybe they desire somewhat to duplicate their dance, to duplicate the singing. Envious, I'm not quite sure about the envious part, but the fear, again, you could see how people would be afraid because as we're talking now in the 1840s and then later we get into the 1850s and you have the publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin and you're talking about abolition. You know, you have folks like Abraham Lincoln talking about abolition and ending slavery. Then there's that fear of, well, what happens if these people are freed, if they're emancipated and now they're competing for jobs, not just in the South, but maybe they migrate, as we know they do later with the Great Migration. Maybe they migrate to the North and now they're competing with us for jobs as well. So it's very complex.
What kinds of characters are we looking at in terms of these minstrel shows? I mean, we have obviously Jim Crow, who's sort of this dancer in tattered clothes, but what other kinds of stereotypes that seem to resonate, as I begin to sort of look at some of the literature, even resonate to this day?
Right. So one of the popular stereotypes would be the dandy. Okay. And, the name they often give was Zip Coon. So the dandy represented the more educated, middle class black person who, you know, lived in the North. And they really made him out to be a buffoon, though. He's speaking with, a big vocabulary and he's misusing words or mispronouncing them with his clothes. He'll have on these ridiculously long, dress coats, top coats, I should say, and top hats. You might have on the white gloves. And, you know, we definitely want to talk about the white gloves later because that's a really important thing. He may have a pocket watch or a watch chain, I should say. So they would make fun of this character. And out of this, you know, the Zip Coon, and then you hear the term coon. So there's this book, Toms, Coons, and Mulattoes by Donald Bogle, who's a black historian. And he wrote about the history of black film. And he also did a book called Primetime Blues about the history of black television. But what he talks about is with these coon characters, these are comical figures. And minstrelsy was about comedy. You know, that's the thing. It was a comedy. So white audiences could watch the minstrels and they could laugh and they could enjoy it. And they didn't feel threatened at all because, again, it was a comedy. So the coon character is somebody that would live on. So as you get into the 30s and the 40s and you'll have films and stars such as Step It, Fetch It, you know, that's the coon. Amos and Annie, that's the coon. And even modern day, and this is somewhat problematic, even modern day, you know, people would try to call certain black comedians coons based on how they perform. And it's always this kind of push and pull because you don't really know exactly, like, is this person really cooning? You know, meaning are they playing on like these stereotypical images of black people just to get laughs from whites in the mainstream? Or are they just being funny? And you've heard the coon term used for, I mean, people from Dave Chappelle to Kevin Hart and Tyler Perry. And again, that's something, you know, maybe we'll get into that later on, you know. And then you have other stereotypes that are going to come out as well. Later, as you get into films such as the Mammy character and some of those. And let me just point out this with the gloves. I was talking about how they would wear those white gloves, right, with the dandy. So minstrelsy, and I don't know if a lot of people notice, but minstrelsy also helped to shape early cartoons in Disney. And Looney Tunes, before there was Looney Tunes, it actually was called Merry Melodies. Okay. So you think about Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd and all of those things, right? Jay-Z, the rapper, he did this video about a year or two ago called The Story of O.J. And the video is, it's a play on O.J. Simpson and something right. O.J. Simpson said some years back. But the video is a cartoon and it has all this racist imagery. And the main character in the cartoon is named Jabbo, which is like a play on the word Sambo. And, you know, you'll notice his character has on the white gloves. And that's hearkening back to Disney. So you see Mickey Mouse with the white gloves, the eyes, the big eyes, the lips, early depictions of Mickey Mouse, you know, Bugs Bunny. You'll see Bugs Bunny with the same thing with the white gloves. There's some early cartoons, and a lot of these have been banned, but you could pull them up on YouTube and you could actually watch them. So there are like some early cartoons where you'll see Mickey Mouse actually in blackface. In some of those cartoons. And a lot of the violence, and, you know, we look at it and we don't really think of it. We think, that's funny. You know, like, you know, those cartoons are kind of violent if you look back at some of them, right? So right. A lot of that was a play on some of the comedic violence that was used within the minstrel shows, which, again, was a play on, you know, the violence on the southern plantations, but it was making it comical. And it's important to note that, like, these cartoons really start becoming popular in the 1930s and the 40s, around the time when the more traditional minstrel show with actual, you know, real life people doing it was dying out. Mm. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So the Civil War comes along, mm-hmm. and obviously the slaves are freed, at least from bondage. How does a minstrel show then begin to change, or how does it grow more? And obviously, eventually, we have the adoption of the label Jim Crow laws.
Yeah. So, and that's a great question. So, with the Civil War, you will start to see a shift in terms of the content within the minstrel shows. In fact, a number of the shows stopped focusing so much on the black characters during that time period. So, you know, they would have more universal characters and more universal storylines. And then what happens is around the 1850s and 1860s, then you also start to see the appearance of black actors in these minstrel shows. So prior to this, you know, it was the white gentleman blackening up with the cork and the grease paint and everything like that. Now you have the black actors getting involved. And that will also make a big shift in minstrelsy, because it's this notion that, well, you know, before you had white actors pretending to be Southern Negroes, but now you have the blacks doing it, and the blacks are more natural because they're black, right? So, you know, the songs they're singing, the dances they're doing, et cetera, I mean, that's natural to them. So it was almost this argument of, well, why do we even need to have white actors doing minstrelsy anymore when we have black actors? Now, people will say, well, why in the world would a black actor do minstrelsy if you know it's demeaning? Keep in mind, so there are reasons for that. Number one, those are the only options. You know, you really didn't have, like, if you wanted to make money, you had to do that. So you didn't really have an option. Number two, and this is also important, for a lot of these black actors, they call it wearing the mask. And Paul Laurence Dunbar, the famous black poet, he did this poem in 1899 called We Wear the Mask. And he talks about black. And it wasn't about minstrelsy, but he was just saying black people have to wear this mask. They have to smile and grin when they aren't really happy. And they have to look content when they're hurting and they're in pain to deal with society. You know, that kind of like the double consciousness that Du Bois talks about. W.B. Du Bois talks about mm-hmm. this double consciousness of trying to be, you know, black and then also being American at the same time. Right. And having that burden on you. So for these black actors, wearing a mask almost made them less threatening to the white audiences watching them. Because the white audiences, when they saw that black mask, they just saw a comic figure. So they weren't offended and they weren't threatened by the fact that these were black men who were up there performing for them. You're also going to get the emergence of folks such as Burt Williams a little later and at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. And Burt Williams is very important to minstrelsy because he becomes the first internationally known black superstar. You know, now some people say that he at one point was making more money than the president. I would have to fact check that, but you know, that's what some folks have said. He was the first black actor to be on Broadway. And the thing about Burt Williams, so he's the gentleman of a West Indian descent, you know, comes from the Bahamas. He gets involved in minstrelsy. He's very fair skinned also. He wasn't a dark skinned man at all. And with what he did that was different from the white actors in the past who were doing minstrelsy and even some of the black minstrels is the fact that he considered himself humanizing that racial stereotype. It's almost like this. So you know, I'm sure like many of your listeners are familiar with the movie The Help from a few years back. It was a book first, and then it became a movie, won many awards. Okay. So the black actresses who starred in The Help said that, you know, they realized that there was going to be backlash within the black community because some people said, you guys are glorifying that mammy figure. You know, think about Going with the Wind and Mammy. You guys are glorifying that mammy figure, this black maid. But what they said they were doing was they were trying to humanize those people and actually give them some dignity and really like tell their stories from a multidimensional perspective. So with Burt Williams, that's what he was trying to do with the minstrels and with the blackface. He said, okay, I'm not going to exaggerate the speech of African Americans. I'm not going to exaggerate the dance and the song. I'm going to do it from a realistic standpoint. Yes, I'm in blackface. And, you know, that actually became, you know, something that he was accustomed and known for was being in blackface. But he's saying that I'm going to, you know, bring it some dignity. And even after his shows, a lot of times he would allow the media to come in and watch him take the, you know, take the makeup off so they could see this transformation from him as this blackface character to like what he actually looked like. And, you know, again, when you saw him in person, he was a fair skinned man, spoke, you know, very good English and grammar. And, you know, he was a big superstar. But, you know, over time, he would become, you know, somewhat of an outcast because people saw him representing minstrelsy and something that was negative. And it wasn't until later in the 70s when people started to kind of look at him differently and actually say, well, no, he was a trailblazer who had to do certain things to pave the way for African-American comics and entertainers.
So I want to turn to the 20th century, and particularly this period. You have the Birth of the Nation, actors in blackface in 1915. You obviously had Woodrow Wilson, who segregated the military, was a racist himself. And also, is this also a period of height, really, of the Ku Klux Klan marching down Pennsylvania Avenue? How does the blackface fit into that, what seems to me almost the height, as it were, of a number of different trends?
Okay. Yeah, excellent question. And before we continue, I know I could run long-winded sometimes, so I just want to know about how much time do we have?
We got about another 10 minutes or so.
Okay, great. All right. Yeah, so Birth of a Nation is a popular film. As you said, you know, Woodrow Wilson views it in the White House, and then you talk about the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan, you know, really comes into being after the Civil War during the Reconstruction period. They die out because you have Ulysses S. Grant passing Ku Klux laws and Congress getting involved. So the Klan dies out. Birth of a Nation is a successful movie. It's the first movie in history, and it depicts the Civil War and the Reconstruction from the Confederate viewpoint. You know, it's actually based on a book called The Klan's Men. So with this film in 1915, it leads to the rebirth of the Klan. So by the time you get into the 1920s, the Klan is running politics in many states, and you have a Klan member who was in the Supreme Court, et cetera, et cetera. As far as the way that blackface plays into this, if you watch the film Birth of a Nation, and everybody should take a look at it, it's on YouTube, you'll see white actors in blackface pretending to be the black Union soldiers. There's a really horrifying scene where one of the soldiers wants to marry this white woman, and, you know, she refuses him, and then he chases after her, and they run through the forest, and she runs up to the top of a cliff and jumps off and kills herself. And in the movie, they use that as what leads to the creation of the Ku Klux Klan. That's not true, but that's how they depict it in the movie. And then in the film, you see blacks, you know, in Congress, and they're drinking liquor, and they got their shoes off, and they're passing laws to say black men and white women could get married. And, you know, so that's where you see blackface, you know, very prominent within that film. Now, again, as I say, once you start to get into the 1930s, blackface starts to, you know, the minstrel shows are, you know, no longer a thing in American pop culture. Now, blackface is still with us, though. But, you know, you don't see people on Broadway and on stages anymore. You'll see it more so in films. Amos and Andy was a popular radio series in the 1930s, started by two white men. And, you know, it started out on the radio, and these white guys are pretending to be black men, and they're speaking with the exaggerated voices that you would have heard in the minstrels. And in fact, they learned that from watching minstrel shows. They made a film about Amos and Andy, and the men played the characters, and they were in blackface. And then later, Amos and Andy actually becomes a TV series in the early 50s. It's the first TV series with an all-black cast. The NAACP boycotts the show and gets it taken off the air. But the black characters who were in the TV series, you know, it's funny. Like, they were told how to talk and how to act by the white creators. So they're saying, you're not speaking black enough. You need to talk like this, or this is how you need to walk. And again, Amos and Andy was a very, very polarizing show within the African-American community. And like I say, it was taken off the air and banned for almost like 3 decades.
Just briefly, we should touch on Al Jolson, made his career as blackface. And towards the end of his career, did not realize or did not understand why people objected. What was his story?
Well, so Al Jolson's story is actually somewhat complicated, right? We tend to hear that name Al Jolson thrown around quite a bit. Even recently on Saturday Night Live, they did a skit about the blackface case in Virginia, and one of the characters mentioned Al Jolson as his hero. So Al Jolson was this actor, entertainer of Jewish descent, who was famous for this film, The Jazz Singer, right? And most people call this the first, you know, talkie, or the first movie with sound and talking, right? And in the film, he, you know, leaves his family and he goes off to become a jazz singer. And there's scenes where he's in blackface and he's performing. And the famous scene is where he sings the song Mammy. Now, a lot of people, you know, look at Al Jolson and say, well, that's the prime example of, you know, white appropriation and, you know, cultural appropriation and white people doing blackface. But the reason I say he's complicated is because, you know, off the set, Jolson was also known for helping black actors and black playwrights. You know, there was a black playwright and he helped him actually get his play, produced. You know, there was, you know, some times where black actors were discriminated against. I forget the gentleman's names, but, you know, they were discriminated against at a restaurant. Jolson heard about it and he got involved, you know, and came to their aid. When Jolson passed away, you had some blacks who actually attended the funeral. And then you had some in the black press who actually wrote positive critiques of his performances in blackface. So that's what I say. He's a complicated character. And in one sense, people will say, well, you know, that Mammy is very racist and it's very demeaning. And then others will say, well, you know, he did that, but then he also was doing certain things that was seen as positive in the black community, too. It's just like with Burt Williams, who I was mentioning earlier. Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois, you know, they said glowing things about Burt Williams in his day. But then you also had people in the black press who were saying that, you know, why are you doing this? You're demeaning the black community and not uplifting the race by performing in blackface.
I want to turn to the 1980s because that's where both certainly the governor and lieutenant governor did their thing when it comes to blackface. And I was reading where there was a suggestion that there was a revival of blackface on college campuses during the period.
You know, and I heard that, you know, again, going back to SNL, they had this joke where they kept saying, well, it was okay in the 80s, you know. I don't, so personally, I don't really get that, the whole the 80s thing and why that would even, I mean, I have some theories as to maybe why, you know, just because I don't want to get too political, but you know, certain things were happening politically at that time in the country. So I could see maybe why some people would start to get into it. What I do know, though, was, you know, after you start getting out of that time period, you do see blackface more and more, as you say, on the college campuses, at the parties. And if you don't mind, like, I like to try to give like a really, really quick timeline of some things from the 80s up through the present to show how blackface has still been with us. Right. So there was a film called Soul Man, which came out, I believe, in the late 80s, early 90s. And you had this white guy who is applying to go to Harvard University. And in order to get into the school under affirmative action, he blackens up. So that's, you know, a case of blackface in Hollywood and in the media. You have, well, obviously, you know, later on, you have the Tropic Thunder film. Now, that's not until 2008 with Tropic Thunder. I think that's important, too, though, because you have Robert Downey Jr., who plays in blackface the whole film. And throughout the movie, there's a black character who's calling him out on it, saying, you know, this is so ridiculous and this is so stupid. And one of the things about that movie that's controversial is directed by Ben Stiller. The movie, the DVD, they had a a feature on the DVD where they apologize to the public. They give a PSA, but the PSA had nothing to do with the blackface. The PSA had to do with the fact that they use retarded and retard throughout the movie. So they're like, well, don't use the R word. But there was nothing at all about the blackface. All right. You know, throughout the 80s, 90s, throughout that time period, you have the Zulu crew at the Mardi Gras parades. Now, this is something that actually goes back, you know, many, many decades at Mardi Gras, where you have these entertainers in blackface, and they still do it to this day, despite people saying that, you know, this is offensive and this is wrong. Now, most of the people who do it are black actors, but you have some white actors who are involved as well, and they don't see it as racist. They see this as being, you know, a part of their culture. And they also just see it as something that's good natured and fun. I know we're focusing on America, but overseas in the Netherlands, when they have their annual, when they stopped doing it, but they had their annual St. Nicholas Day, what, you know, think St. Nicholas, mm-hmm. you think of Santa Claus here in America. You know, they had this character, it's a children's character by the name of Black Pete. And Black Pete was a character in blackface, and Black Pete would come down the chimney like with Santa. And if the kids were bad, then Black Pete would punish them. So on, you know, the holiday, people would dress up in blackface to imitate Black Pete. And even the prime minister in Belgium, I remember he talked about, and this is funny because you talked about Northam, the prime minister in Belgium talked about how, you know, it was so hard to get the paint off of his face, but he didn't find anything offensive with it. Right. You know, you have restaurants throughout the U.S. There's a Sambo's restaurant. Now, Sambo's, again, you know, comes from that famous character Sambo. You have 47 states in the U.S. who had chains to the Sambo's restaurants, but that dies out once you start to get into the early 80s. But then there was still Mammy's Cupboard, which is a restaurant in Mississippi, and there's a big mammy outside of the restaurant shaped like a mammy. Right. And you walk in the door. Now, that still exists today. Coming back to the films, again, I mentioned Tropic Thunder. Robert Downey Jr., 2008, gets an Oscar nomination around the same time that President Obama is sworn into office as our first black president in the United States. And then later on, there are other examples, whether it's Jimmy Kimmel in blackface mm-hmm. doing Oprah, doing the basketball player Karl Malone on Comedy Central's The Man Show.
I was going to ask you, by the way, because there was criticism, you know, Billy Crystal, for instance, does Sammy mm-hmm. Davis Jr. Fred Armisen played, obviously, Obama and Prince mm-hmm. Darkened. Some have suggested that the context for those particular characters is different in the sense that I think it was Armisen who said that he felt comfortable because he wasn't trying to create a stereotype of some kind. What about that? Obviously, they're dramatically different than the original minstrel shows, mm-hmm. but I mean, what?
That's still problematic, yeah. though. It's still problematic yeah. because then that's the same issue that's the reason why people had a problem with the governor of Virginia putting on some paint to look like Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
You know, or the reason why people had an issue with Herring from Virginia, Mark Herring,
right.
doing, you know, Curtis Blow, the rapper. You know, and then that comes back to this whole issue of the kids at the college campuses doing blackface. UCLA, they had Sigma Phi Epsilon, which is a fraternity, and then Alpha Phi Sorority in 2015 in UCLA had a Kanye West Western where the kids were supposed to be imitating Kanye West, the rapper, and then his wife, Kim Kardashian. But then they also started imitating, you know, black gangster rappers. Mm. And they didn't look at that as we're poking fun. This is like, hey, we're just doing this. You know, there's a woman on one of those Real Housewife reality shows who, you know, got done up as Diana Ross. Megyn Kelly, who got fired from NBC, even mentioned this.
Right.
You know, she was saying, well, you know, she wanted to look like Diana Ross, and she put on some tan, spray tan, and darkened up a little bit and put on a wig, and that's an homage to Diana Ross. That's not, you know, that's not racist. But that's the problem, because, again, people started doing this, and for them, it may not be racist because they don't know that history and that pain that comes along with it for folks who might look like me, who may see that and think, you don't really have to do that. You know, you could imitate the person, but you don't have to darken your skin to imitate that person.
Well, perhaps to finish with a quote from Amiya Moody Ramirez, who's a professor, and she said, if you have to think about it and ask if it's okay, then it probably is not okay. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us and give us really this rich history about blackface and minstrel and its significance to this day.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Joshua Wright, associate professor at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And this has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The Eastern Shore was a place where slavery intertwined itself with society, despite a significant free black population. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The first settlers arrived in the 1630s, eventually established slavery that included enversmen looking for what was called seasoned Negroes. Plantation system changed over the years as crop changed, but by then the system had become embedded into society. Jacqueline Simmons Hedberg has written a new book entitled Plantations, Slavery, and Freedom on Maryland's Eastern Shore. She explores the system that lasted through the Civil War, but also produced some of the major figures in the abolition movement. And we have her on the line this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So how did you get interested in writing this book and the situation with slaves on the Eastern Shore?
Well, in 2015, I read an article in Smithsonian Magazine written by Edward Ball that was called Slavery's Trail of Tears. And it talked about the internal slave trade when a million slaves were moved from the Upper South to the sugarcane and cotton fields of plantations of the South. I majored in U.S. history in college, and I didn't know a single thing about that. I mean, I knew about Indians being moved, but I didn't know about slaves being moved. And so it kind of upset me that I didn't know anything about that. And I went back to my old textbook, which I still have. I looked up the domestic slave trade, and I found 3-page references. None of them said that a million slaves had been moved, and only one of them even mentioned the word coffle. Nobody said slaves walked to the South. So I started reading, you know, why was my education missing? What was I lacking? And the more I read, the angrier I got. So I ended up teaching a class at Osher Institute of Towson University, 4 weeks, called Free Blacks and Slaves on Maryland's Eastern Shore. And when I finished, some of the students said, there are a lot of people who don't know this. These lectures should be written. And that's where the book came from.
And did you, your family, is there a personal connection here, you say?
Absolutely. I was born on Hopper's Island. I'm a graduate of Wicomico High School. My family's been on the Eastern Shore since it was first settled in 1659. And my ancestors had slaves. I know the names of 79 of them. And so when I started to do this class, I thought, well, I can't do a class about slavery in toto. I don't know that much about it, but I do know about the Eastern Shore. So I started concentrating my research on the Eastern Shore, and that became the focus of my examples in my class.
So why did slavery then develop on the Eastern Shore, as opposed to obviously other places?
Well, it developed because of the tobacco economy. You need a lot of labor to grow tobacco, and you've got to tend it all year round. So in the beginning, there were a lot of white indentured servants who came from England. Conditions changed. Things got better in England. The government in Maryland made it more difficult for people to get land after they had been here. So there were fewer indentured servants, and there was a rise in tobacco prices. So planters needed labor, and slaves were the alternative.
Why were they so adaptable in terms of what the plantation owners were looking for?
Well, you know, they were no more adaptable than the white indentured servant. I mean, and actually in the beginning on the Eastern Shore, almost all the farmers had only small plots of land, and the farmer and his family was the total labor source. But as the as the plantations got a little bit bigger and you needed more labor, if they had a little money, they would hire indentured servants. And everybody worked the same way. You know, they worked according to the same rules. They generally followed common practices in England. It wasn't any different for the slave. But as there came to be more African slaves and fewer indentured servants, and as the plantations got bigger and smaller farmers disappeared, you know, the people who had money bought out their neighbors, the conditions changed. And that happened at the beginning of the 18th century, what I call in my book the Plantation Revolution. That changed everything. You know, it became more violent. It became more regimented. it became more difficult for the laborers.
Describe some of that, because the conditions in terms, I understand, obviously they were harsher, but there was less time off, there was more discipline, even branding. I mean, what that, as well as a class of various slaves, whether it's in the house or the field?
Yes. First of all, I think the owners sort of separated themselves from their laborers. They hired overseers. So the owners no longer working in the fields. That made a difference. Then as time went on, it became more regimented. They put slaves into teams and, you know, this one for this field, this team for this field, this team for the other. The hours got longer. They didn't work according to common English practices any longer when they weren't white workers. The owners felt like they could do whatever they wanted to do. And in fact, they could do whatever they wanted to do because they controlled the government. They were the representatives at the assembly. They made the laws. They controlled the courts. They were the judges. They were even the deacons in the church. So they controlled all the institutions of society. And it became every year, I mean, you can sort of go through the legislative records and see how the laws got harsher and harsher and harsher. I mean, you mentioned branding. You know, one of the first things that they did is that the second time somebody ran away, they branded him with an R on his forehead. Later, they cut off ears. I mean, it really harsh punishments. And the whip was common practice. And there were owners who got reputations for breaking slaves or overseers who had that reputation. And they made a habit of whipping either one slave or more on a regular basis on the plantation.
And there was also, I guess, a series of acts that were imposed in terms of slave catchers passing, you know, in terms of right. The slaves. And tell me a little bit about those.
Well, they started off with you had to have, it, originally it said slave and servant. It was all workers had to have passes to go from one plantation to another. Then they dropped that and it became only slaves. They had to have a ticket. It had to be signed. If they were more than 10 miles away from their plantation, they didn't have a ticket, they were considered a runaway. So then they were locked up in jail. Second offense, they were branded. Then you had rules that there would be no free time for the independent economy for the slaves. You know, before, if they'd had some time off, they could go fishing and sell their catch or something like that. That was no longer allowed. You know, the punishments got harsher. I mean, at one point, there's even it's horrible to imagine that they could have passed a law that said you would draw and quarter somebody. But if a slave was convicted of instituting rebellion or what they, you know, stirring up rebellion, or if they raped a white woman, they could literally have their body drawn and quartered with the pieces of the body put up prominent places around the community. And it's just hard to imagine that those were. And then they passed laws that said you can't free your slave except by a deed, and they have to be over 50. They've got to be able to work, and all the different kinds of rules that were established.
Now, we eventually see a decline in the tobacco. How does that impact, then, the plantations and farming in general on the Eastern Shore?
Okay, that made a difference, big difference in the Eastern Shore. And even as early as the 1750s, the northern counties, Queen Anne's, Kent, Cecil, they had dropped tobacco altogether and were becoming the center of wheat, corn, flour production for the colony. So when that happens, you don't need slave labor constantly all year round. You only need them for the planting and you need them for the harvesting. So you have a lot of time in the middle when they're free, and they began hiring out practices. They would hire their slaves, you know, to other people. Slaves began to work in shipbuilding. They began to work in timbering industries, so they no longer were all field slaves, and that was a difference. And then I think a really big difference is that the traffic on the Chesapeake Bay changed. In early colonial days, it was constant back and forth across especially at the lower end, Dorchester County to Calvert County are very close. Those were back and forth, you know, on a daily, weekly basis. But when tobacco is not grown in all the plantations, the movement becomes a north-south movement. And Chestertown and Baltimore Town, which wasn't founded until 1729, that town, they become much more important. Places like Oxford lost their significance. When that happens, of course, you get the bay being a barrier, people becoming more isolated. They don't go to Paris. They don't go to Amsterdam. They don't go to London. So they become more insular and parochial in their own surroundings. You get to the point where people don't leave the Eastern Shore at all in their lifetime. That makes them less open. It also meant that they were less interested in having relationships with, better relationships with these laborers that had come from this distant place and look different.
Now, you talk about this moving from a slave society to a society with slaves. What's the distinction you're making there?
Well, there was a University of Maryland professor, Dr. Ira Berlin, who wrote a series of books, the first one beginning Slaves Without Masters, where he talked about the free blacks. And he made a distinction, and he said, in some societies, you have a few slaves, and they don't make any difference. They're not essential to the economy. New England had slaves. Those slaves didn't have much to do with all the kind of economy that they developed because it wasn't as intensive. So as long as you only had few numbers and they're not central to the economy, you also don't have big planters dominating the political system. When the tobacco became essential, the central part of the economy, and you need lots of labor and you need it year-round, then you've got a different situation altogether. The number of slaves that were bought in the Chesapeake at the end of the 17th century, the beginning of the 18th century, skyrocketed. And when that happened, you ended up with a society that was totally dependent upon slave labor. I think one of the historians talked about how important tobacco was to the Tidewater economy, Virginia and Maryland together, and it was about 75% of the trade that was going into the Chesapeake. So at that point, slaves were really essential. Now on the Eastern Shore, at about the time, same about the time of the American Revolution, when people begin to change to mixed farming, dairy farming, wheat, corn, and less tobacco, then you needed fewer and fewer slaves. And of course, when you do that, what do you do with the excess numbers of slaves? That, of course, gets all tied up in the domestic slave trade.
Well, as a matter of fact, address that. I mean, the most famous figure, I think, is the woman out of Delaware? I'm trying to think of her name.
Patty Cannon.
Yeah, Patty Cannon. And I mean, she was actually a minor character in many ways as opposed to some of the folks coming out of Baltimore. But tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, Patty Cannon was known as a kidnapper. You know, she lived at a very convenient location. Her house was at the border where Delaware, Dorchester County, and Caroline County met, and she and her son-in-law, Joe Johnson, would kidnap free blacks and slaves all up and down the Eastern Shore all the way to Philadelphia, and then they would ship them to Georgia. I think the kidnapping business sort of got interrupted by the War of 1812. Then after the war, when the demand for slaves increased because the country was expanding and the cotton gin had been invented, and so more labor was needed in the South, then whereas Patty Cannon had only shipped, let's say, dozens of slaves, you get people like Franklin and Armitage who send hundreds of thousands or thousands of slaves. Woolfolk's was really big on the Eastern Shore. I think there was a period of time when more than half the percentage of the slaves that were being sent south out of the Port of Baltimore were ones that were going because Woolfolk was selling them south. And then there was Franklin and Armfield in Alexandria. He had most of the people that they were taking south walked, which is even a sadder story, walking in coffles that were in chains all the way from Alexandria across Virginia, across Tennessee, across Mississippi to Natchez. Just millions of people moved.
So what did that do in terms of the Eastern Shore, this shifting away from this intense slave population that was required? And I assume that you have, in some fashion or another, a growing free black population.
You absolutely do. It wasn't just growing. It was exploding. At the time of the War of Independence, there was a sort of a rush of feeling that well, it wasn't quite fair to fight for independence and still have slavery. So on the Eastern Shore, there was a flood of manumissions, hundreds of them. In my book, I talk about Thomas Bishop, who was a Hooper's Island slave who was freed. I think you can read lots of people in all, I think all the counties of the Eastern Shore freed them. Then in addition to that, you've got, you know, the normal increase of population. And as this free black population grew, the people around began to wonder how they were going to deal with all these free blacks, which led to a whole different kind of problem. You know, it was a case where I'm all in favor of manumission, but I don't want them living next to me.
Do we then have some the black codes then that enter the picture?
Yep, every year, year after year after year. They were forced to register. You know, here they are, free people, but they had to go to the magistrate every year, pay a fee, register. You had to have a description of them, how they had been freed, whether they had any marks. Then they had to have licenses. They had to have a license to sell corn. They had to have a license to have a dog. They had to have a license to sell tobacco. Then they couldn't move around freely. If they left, let's say if they became free and they visited someone in some other state, they could only be gone for so long. If somebody from another state came here, they could only stay so long. Eventually, there were rules that you couldn't manumit anybody. And the very worst one at the end said if you were older than 18, you could put yourself back into slavery. So the laws got worse and worse and worse and worse as time went on.
By the way, you mentioned that Maryland had its own Amistad. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, everybody knows about, I think, the story of Amistad, where you have these slaves that have been captured, or they're on being brought to the Caribbean, and they seize control of the ship. In the story of Amistad, eventually their case makes it to court, and John Quincy Adams defends them, and they win their court case. I tell in the book that Austin Woolfolk's had a group of slaves who similarly gained control of their ship. It was the Decatur. The only problem was they didn't know how to sail it, so it floated kind of free. A whaler came alongside of them, and eventually they split up the group, took part of them to New York, and left the second group with the crew of the ship that were now put back in charge of the ship. The ones who went to New York disappeared in the docks. They captured one of them in Westchester. He was tried for the murder of the captain and the first mate and was executed. Now, we only know about it because it was written in a Baltimore newspaper. And the newspaper stirred up quite a story. Benjamin Lundy was the head of the Universal Enquirer, and he said that Woolfolk's was a villain and that he should be punished. Woolfolk's attacked Benjamin Lundy on the streets of Baltimore, beat him up, and left him there. He was charged with assault. He was found guilty, and the punishment was $1. Because the judge said that what Woolfolk's was doing was wonderful. It was freeing Maryland of a lot of rascals that we didn't need to have here.
So Maryland also, and particularly the Eastern Shore, is the site of, as I mentioned earlier, those who were prominent in the abolitionist movement. Obviously, we have Frederick Douglass. We had Harriet Tubman. Why is it, do you think, that we see such prominent figures coming out of this, as you indicate, this fairly isolated area?
Well, I think Frederick Douglass was a genius. I mean, in all honesty, I think there are just some people who are born really, really smart. He had an unusual situation that as a child he came to Baltimore. His mistress, who had never had a slave before, taught him the alphabet until her husband put a stop to it. So he already had begun to see that education was really important. He said that when Hugh Auld stopped his wife from teaching Freddie Bailey at that time, he said he understood then what it was that enabled a white person to have control over black people. And so he determined that he would be educated. So he continued to study the alphabet. He got kids in the street helping with words. He eventually bought a book of orations and speeches and practiced those. And then he taught himself how to write. He worked in Hugh Auld's shipyard, and he saw the letters on the lumber that was stacked up. There was F, that was forward, and A was aft, and S was starboard, and they had L, which was larboard. We usually say port. But he learned those four letters. He learned how to write those. Then he went back to where he was living, and the little boy he was taking care of was, by this time in school, he had copybooks. And when he discarded the copybooks, Freddie Bailey would take those copybooks and copy his own letters. So, you know, he was a person who was striving his whole life to really know and understand. Well, his life got sort of railroaded when he was brought back to the Eastern Shore when he was a teenager, about 15. He was sent to be a field slave to one of these overseers who thought you should break people. He was whipped every week until his back was... He actually ran away at one point, went back to his owner and said, I can't do this anymore. And the owner said, you have to go. I have a contract. You have to go back. I need, you know, if I'm going to get my money, you have to go back and work. So he went back, but he vowed that he was not going to stay in slavery. He was captured the first when he tried to run away, ended up in the Easton jail. His owner sent him back to Baltimore again. This time, he got Seaman's papers that had been used in foreign ports to show that they were Americans. He dressed like a sailor, boarded the railroad, and escaped. So I think he's just an unusual person who happened to have something really special happen to him when he came to Baltimore. I think that made a big difference. Now, Harriet Tubman is a different kind of genius. She was... As a child, was hired out. She worked in muskrat fields. She got the measles. She got really sick. The man that had hired her finally sent her back to her owner. Her mother helped her come get back to health, and then he hired her out again. This time he was hired to a woman who beat her all the time, and she's still young. If you go to the Harriet Tubman Museum in Golden Hill, they have a bust of Harriet Tubman, and they've made the welts on the back of her neck, which is just amazing to me, that you can just feel where she was scarred for life. So after she ran away the first time, and her brothers made her come back, they kind of lost their courage. Second time, she ran away by herself, and she said that she had a right to freedom, and that if they captured her, they'd have to kill her. Now, I think the really unusual thing about Harriet Tubman is that she had such strong ties to her family that she risked her own life over and over again. You know, she came back a dozen times to rescue her family, and in the process, of course, helped other people get to freedom as well. And then she devoted her whole life to things that were causes. You know, she was a scout in the Civil War. It's possible that she even led a contingency in battle. She later created an old people's home in New York. She was an active suffragette. I mean, she really was quite an amazing person. I don't know what makes a soil breed amazing people. Maybe there's something in the water of the Eastern Shore. I don't know. But those two people were really special. There are some others, though. You know, there's Sam Green, who was a free black who lived in East New Market. He was a literate slave who bought his own freedom and then bought his wife's freedom. He was never able to buy his children's freedom. He was a minister, highly respected in his community. But when a group of eight slaves ran away, people began to say, well, Reverend Green must have helped them. And they got a warrant to search his house. They found a number of what we might say were interesting items. They found a map of Canada, a letter from his son, who by this time had escaped, some railroad schedules in New Jersey. And they found a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Well, the legislature had, about 10 years before that, passed a bill that said, if you have any abolitionist material, that's a felony, and you can be sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison. So here is this respected free black minister, because he has a copy of this book. He was sentenced to 10 years in the Maryland pen. So he was an amazing person, too. You know, I think everybody who ran away was amazing because it was such a struggle. They didn't know the geography. They didn't know how far away they were. Some of them, they certainly never heard of Canada. I think the story of the black population on the Eastern Shore and throughout the United States who ran away during those years, you risked a lot.
Now, Maryland becomes one of the first states to abolish slavery through their new constitution. What happened there, and what was the kind of vote we were seeing from the delegates from the Eastern Shore?
Well, there was a constitutional convention in 1864, which in the end did pass Article 23, which ended slavery in Maryland. But first, you have to vote whether or not you're going to have a constitutional convention. Eastern Shore delegates kind of split on that. Caroline and Talbot County were always in favor of that. Most of the other ones were not so much. Then you had long discussions about whether this act really should be passed. And you can read how the Eastern Shore was divided. I mean, there were people who said slavery was a moral wrong, like James Valiant, who came from Talbot County. And on the other hand, you can have people like Isaac Jones from Somerset County who said slaves are inferior, slavery's been here since the beginning, it's in the Bible, it should be. Slaves are property, you can't take them away. So the vote was close. The middle shore voted in favor of the amendment. The southern shore did not vote in favor of the amendment, but it passed nonetheless quite handily by about more than 2-1. Then, of course, you've got to put it on the ballot in order to pass the Constitution. Well, the Constitution itself, that question on the ballot, only won by 770 votes or so. So it was very close. Most of the Eastern Shore did not vote for it. Caroline and Talbot County again accepted. The thing that really put the numbers over the top was that Union soldiers voted significantly in favor of it. And so the Constitution of 1864 was passed.
So what do you think we can learn from this history, which seems so far away now in terms of where we are? And how do you see it reflected in how we deal with the issue of race and so on? We obviously have had controversies over the Confederate statues. The Talbot Boys comes to my mind. What do you think we have to learn?
Well, I think, first of all, we ought to understand that the roots to the problem are deep, that attitudes that blacks are inferior have been with us since colonial days. We haven't done anything to accept the free black population in many cases. When the Civil War amendments were passed, although Maryland had freed the slaves, the 14th Amendment that granted citizenship and the 15th that granted the right to vote were not passed by the Maryland legislature. Maryland didn't ratify the 14th Amendment until about 1959, and we didn't ratify the 15th Amendment until 1973. So obviously the feelings have stuck around regardless what the law says. I think people shouldn't say slavery was a long time ago and it didn't have anything to do with me, because I think every one of us, if we go back in their history, I mean, even if you're not like me and you haven't been here forever, your family came from somewhere, and they all benefited. If you are white, they benefited from slavery, whether it was from the tobacco that you smoked in your pipe or the sugar you put in your tea or the cotton that you wore on your back. So I don't think people should dismiss it and say, this has nothing to do with me. It has a lot to do with you. And, you know, when I went back to my history textbook, I found things in that book that I thought, how could I possibly have ever been taught that? I was taught that most slaves were adequately fed and were happy. You know, logic would have told me that if they were happy, why were they all running away? But I'm sure I didn't question it then. It was only, I think only when you sort of grow up and look at what the story of history is, can you realize that we've really treated the black population in America terribly, whether it's on the Eastern Shore or elsewhere, and we have to do better. And I think a part of doing better is knowing the facts.
We've been speaking with Jacqueline Simmons-Henver. She's written a new book entitled Plantation, Slavery, and Freedom on Maryland's Eastern Shore. It explores a system that lasted through the Civil War, but also produced, as we said, some of the most important abolitionist figures in the country's history. And we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this morning.
It's been my pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.